Hey, nurse leaders, how are you retaining your new nurses? How do you make sure that support systems you have in place will retain new nurses within the next 6 to 12 months? In this episode, our guest shares innovative practices they've implemented in redesigning the nurse residency program to optimize engagement and increase retention of new nurses, which has led to over 90% of retention rates in their organization. He also shares the vital role of critical reflection in assisting new nurses in developing resilience through peer support in addressing moral distress that has greatly contributed to their high retention rates. Stay tuned to learn more. Welcome to the Insightful Nurse Leader. This is a podcast by nurse leaders for nurse leaders. This show is focused on assisting leaders become effective managers and change facilitators. I'm your host, Miles Perilla. Join me every week as I speak with fellow nurse leaders, share insights, lessons learned, and practical advice. So, whether you're a seasoned frontline leader, a budding charge nurse, an experienced manager, or executive, you don't want to miss this. Dr. Albert Bellaro, welcome to the show. Dr. Albert, can you share about your background and your area of expertise?
Thank you for having me and making me a part of your podcast. I have a long background in nursing. I graduated before my 20th birthday from the Philippines and came here in the United States in 1992. Barely practiced a lot in the Philippines, maybe a couple of years, but most of my nursing practice has been in the United States, started Bronx. I specialized in critical care, got certified, did my master's at NYU, finished my nurse practitioner degree, but didn't really get to practice the nurse practitioner degree because my mentor, who eventually became my sponsor, recruited me to be the director of professional practice and education at the hospital that I was practicing as a clinical nurse. So that really jump-started my career in a different path. I never expected leadership in education. I always had a long-term plan for clinical nursing, but that mentor and sponsor really catapulted me to that path of doing nursing education and nursing leadership. Several years later, I was recruited by my same sponsor to a small community hospital in Brooklyn. And that's where I really got to learn the ropes in terms of leadership. I was running the education department with my sponsor being the chief nurse. And so I got to influence nursing practice at that community hospital in a big way, starting with making sure that the nursing practice was really up to standard. And once we met that threshold, we pursued nursing excellence. Nursing excellence these days can be measured differently. A lot of organizations measure that in terms of their magnet designation. But for us, being a small community hospital, we measured nursing excellence through nurse retention. We measured it through quality measures, like the publicly reported quality measures like HCAHPS, hospital acquired conditions, accreditation. And from those measures, we really made a big difference in this hospital's nursing practice. So my background, starting from the clinical nursing arena, quickly turned towards education and leadership and into professional practice in a big way in the Brooklyn Hospital. In my current role, I'm a director of professional practice at a system level in a large public health system here in New York City. And in that role, the big difference is that I get to do the impact in a bigger way rather than in a small way, as I was able to do it in the community hospital in Brooklyn. So my current role as a nurse executive is a director of professional practice, and it's running the nurse residency program and making sure that we have transition to practice programs that are effective in retaining nurses within the system of 11 hospitals and 4 specialty sites.
Fantastic. That's a huge role. So you mentioned about quality metrics and as measures of success, and part of that were retention rates. Can you talk about what are the main driving factors for improving or sustaining a high level of quality for your area of focus?
The sponsor that I worked for influenced my view a lot in terms of what quality means, because she was previously in a quality role prior to getting me into that role that she previously enacted, so to speak, in her previous role. And the thinking about quality then was just by, if a hospital have better data or have better metrics, then that's quality. But again, her influence on me became really different because our definition of quality really is, where are you starting? What's the baseline? Where do you want to go? And how do you want to get there? So, of course, reimbursement and the regulatory environment were big influences because working in a community hospital, reimbursement played a big role.
Mm-hmm.
So we targeted the quality measures that would give us the bigger reimbursement for things like the publicly reported hospital measures in CMS, patient satisfaction, hospital-acquired conditions like zero CORI, zero pressure ulcers, now called pressure injury, zero CLABSI. And those were the quality measures that we adopted early on because those were the priority for the hospital to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But then we realized nursing really plays a big role in keeping that quality measure where it should be because a lot of the processes that result in the outcomes for those metrics were really nursing driven.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's how, you know, the current literature describes it as nursing sensitive outcomes because it's really driven in a large part by the way that nurses deliver nursing care. So as an example, if you target patient satisfaction, nurses are the folks that admit and discharge patients. Physicians treat the patient's condition, but then again, their interaction with the patients and the families may be just a small portion of that larger context of interactions by clinicians with patients and families. The bulk of that interaction is really nursing care. So the impression that the patients get about their care in the hospital is influenced by a large part by the nurse. So we had to figure out, how do you get the nurse to keep that interaction at a high level versus just episodic, where whenever they interact is only where they are concerned about keeping that intensity up. But we had to do it as a community where every nurse should really have the same level of interaction with the patients and family rather than just the day nurses, for example. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's figuring out how the nurses are going to sustain the high quality that we committed to for that hospital. And a big part of that engagement by the nurse is really making sure that the leaders of those nurses are able to articulate what's the common understanding of why we want to go where we want to go. So our path to changing the nurse's way of thinking at the bedside is really influenced a lot by the kind of leaders you promote and work with those nurses. So those leaders were suddenly a priority for that hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So my chief nurse, who was my sponsor, when we came to the hospital, the first priority was, let's get our leaders through a leadership academy program so that they would know how to lead. Because we knew from our previous experience that a lot of our leaders are just promoted because they're clinical experts, not necessarily because they have the leadership competencies.
Mm-hmm.
And having leadership competencies is a world apart from just being a clinical expert. When you're a clinical expert, I think one of the business leaders, Jack Welch, was saying, when you're a star performer, it's all about you, right? When you're at the staff nurse level. But when you become a leader, suddenly it's not all about you. It's about the people around you, right? So getting the leader to really drive excellence at the bedside was the key to getting that hospital that we worked for over maybe a 10-year period to really achieve the kind of quality that we were able to achieve for that small hospital. Unfortunately, that hospital is now closed. We were part of the Brooklyn redesign. So that small hospital, the beds for that small hospital have now been absorbed into a bigger system. So, but one of the things that we were proud of before that hospital closed is the high level of quality, and the pinnacle of which was the designation as a top performer while we were running the show.
Got it. Thank you for sharing that. A lot of insightful background information there. So it sounded like you were able to really hone in on the very key component of maintaining the nurse-sensitive drivers, which are developing leaders. So questions on that one. Were you able to scale that program that you were able to train leaders and such with the other hospitals and health systems?
When we were at that hospital, we were not part of the big system yet. We were a standalone community hospital. When we integrated into the bigger systems, we really merged with two other hospitals, and those three hospitals that we were now part in when our small hospital was absorbed by that larger health system, the way that we integrated was really more about how do we role model what we've achieved at our small hospital to the other two hospitals that merged with us. So we were never really able to actualize that kind of practice, scaling it up to the other two hospitals, but we certainly gave them the tools on how we got to where we were in terms of quality. At one point, out of the 11 hospitals in the borough of Brooklyn, we were the top performer in terms of nurse communication. The other two hospitals out of the 11 who merged with us, they were either at the lower percentile or at the bottom of that 11 hospital cohort for the borough of Brooklyn. So they were very interested in learning from us as we merged and learned from how we were able to achieve the high level of patient satisfaction that we were able to achieve. So in a sense, our work was not really fully complete to scale up, but we were able to share the best practices that achieved results for us to the other two hospitals.
Amazing. Thank you. The other follow-up question I have is regarding leadership development. How do you determine who have the potential to be a good leader? And the other part of that is, did you have a homegrown leadership development program?
So the leadership potential was a very subjective kind of a measure. When we started the Leadership Academy at that small hospital in Brooklyn, the thinking was we're not just going to do it in the nursing department. We're going to include the leaders in the other departments. So that Leadership Academy included folks from nutrition, folks from finance, those mid-level managers that they had in their department as part of our Leadership Academy program. In terms of determining who to involve in the Leadership Academy, we relied on the recommendations of the department head for the other departments. But for our nursing department, we included all the frontline bedside nurse managers. All of our frontline bedside nurse managers, we thought that they could benefit from the Leadership Academy. Even though, you know, most of them were just promoted for their clinical expertise. We knew that for a couple of the nurse leaders that are really leaders in that group, our thinking was that they can learn something from them. So we included everybody in the nursing department. We relied on the department head for the other departments. So it was a very inclusive program. It was a homegrown program. My chief nurse had background in doing leadership training, but I didn't. So she sent me to Villanova, sent me to Wharton, sent me to, there was another academy that I went to that she sent me to just learn the ropes and really learning the content of those programs and transposing that and reinventing that in the small community hospital. We were a very resource poor organization. So we had to think creatively about designing programs that would help our leaders without spending tons of money. So we couldn't really pay consultants, and consultants are paid at a premium. So what we had to rethink was how can we learn from the curriculum of other leadership academies and transpose that to our curriculum in the homegrown program. So to answer your question, yes, it was a homegrown program. And the selection criteria for the other departments was based on the recommendations of the department head. But for the nursing department, we included all the frontline leaders for all our units.
So formed a nurse residency program at your organization that resulted to over 90% of retention rates. Can you talk about how you were able to accomplish this?
So here at my current role, we knew from the get-go. I started a few months after my boss hired me. So we were not far apart in terms of, you know, starting it in this big system that we're working for right now. And one of the things that we knew when we started here was that there was a huge retention problem because we were hiring hundreds of nurses, but a lot of nurses were not staying, you know, in the 12 months. Even in the 12 months that we measure our retention rates from, they're not even finishing the 12 months and they leave and go to other hospitals within the community. So we knew that we had a big retention problem. We were a revolving door. But one of the things out there that is evidence-based is that a residency program helps retain nurses. And this residency program, which has been around for 10 years before we even started here, already demonstrated good outcomes. This residency program was started by the chief nurse at NYU, who did the residency program, you know, 10 years ago with the NYU nurses. And their outcomes show that when new nurses who are new graduates are put in a residency program where they are continuously supported over 12 months, their decision to stay is higher, mm-hmm. as demonstrated by the retention rate in a 12-month period. And so we were fortunate to have that kind of strong evidence from the literature that a nurse residency program really retains nurses. The other stroke of luck that we were lucky to get was that the mayor of New York, the mayor of the city of New York, put together this consortium of all the hospitals in the city and paid for the expense of putting up a residency program for the first couple of years, mm-hmm. all expenses paid by the city. So two things that really played a big part in the luck that we were able to get was that, you know, there was evidence that a residence program works, and the funding came out from the city of New York, putting us with all the other 20 plus hospitals in the city into this consortium of hospitals that will bring up a residency program. The difference between us and the other hospital was that they were doing their residency programs at a small scale. We decided to do it in a bigger scale. So we are a health system of about 11 hospitals. And what we did was, instead of running the residency program at the local hospital level, we decided to run the program at a central level. The advantages to that was that we were able to strategize at a scaled up kind of a context, and the kind of savings that we would get would be put together in terms of the number of hospitals that we have, but also the enrollment would also be at a bigger scale. Rather than having seminars for 10 people, for example, it would have seminars for a bigger group of people. So the advantages of running a residency program at scale was very obvious. And for us, we just took the bold vision of our chief nurse executive to say, we're bleeding nurses, let's fix it. Let's run this residency program. And the goal is really to beat the market retention rates. And the market retention rates, what she meant was, you know, what's the current retention rate out there? And it turns out this company that runs the residency program now for over 10 years, their retention rate was 91%. And so we said, let's run the program to either meet that benchmark or exceed it. And from the get-go, that was our goal. And for the first year, we were able to hit very close to the target. For the second year, we exceeded the target. And currently, right now, we're exceeding the target again. So there were many things that contributed to those retention rates. But what we know is that there's strong evidence out there in the literature that residency programs really work. And that's evidence that has been running for 10 years. So it's really taking something that works out of research, out of the nursing literature, and just putting it into practice.
I like how you were able to implement that system-wide, because you got the advantage of the economies of scale, right, compared to other hospitals starting it rather in a smaller scale. But with that, did it not require a larger resource pool, such as educators and such?
So we had to put the need for resource at a very contextualized kind of an approach. The way that local hospitals run residency programs is they dedicate an educator to manage the program, do the recruitment, run the seminars, recruit the subject matter experts, and then coach the nurses in between seminars. So that was the model at the small level. Our model at the big level was, we're running seminars once a month, right? So you would really just need educators once a month, because we had a central staff that runs all the recruitment, all the screening, all the calendar invitations, which are some of the grunt work that really goes into doing the residency program, not the value-added work like coaching the nurses, interacting with them, helping them with critical reflection, helping them with evidence-based projects. So we were able to manipulate the resources a little bit so that the logistics parts were handled by a different group of people. But really, the engagement part required fewer time commitment, a smaller time commitment in terms of the educators. Remember that we're just going to do seminars once a month. But then the interaction is optimized to be really a FaceTime with the nurse residents who are new, who needed coaching. So in short, it's really reimagining the resources that you're going to throw into a residency program, by separating what are the things that are logistics, which are sort of the administrative part of running the program, and separating that from the value-added part, which is engaging the nurses, coaching the nurses, helping them in critical reflection, helping them with evidence-based projects, and really getting the educators to focus on those value-added roles and responsibilities rather than spend the valuable time of the educators in the logistics piece. So that was the difference that we were able to do by running the program at a central level, because we were able to separate the logistics part from the engagement part.
And focus on the real value, which is
focus on using the educators where they matter, not using them by sending calendar invites, by sending notices, by getting Excel spreadsheets. Those are the non-value-added work that an educator can be entangled on if you run a residency program.
Agreed. You mentioned a few keywords, value-added and non-value-added. Did you do any value stream analysis on this program before you implemented?
We didn't do a value stream analysis. We did a gap analysis, the basic gap analysis in terms of what's the current engagement, what's the resource that we have. And we visualized the hours commitment in terms of the hours that we would need them every month, right? And the hours that they dedicate to the program every month. If you have a full-time nurse educator running a local clinical nurse residency program, that one FTE is dedicated to the NRP, right? But for us, that one FTE, we only need 4 hours a month from that one FTE from the various hospitals. So we pull the resources. And since we run big cohorts, our big cohorts may be cohorts of 100 or more, we needed educators, several educators every seminar, about 8 or 10 educators. But those educators only stay with us 4 hours once a month. So rather than choke them up in running the program, we ran the program behind the scenes, but they came to us when we needed them to really interact with the nurses. So we didn't do a value stream analysis. We thought that this was not suitable for value stream analysis, being that it's not really, a process-driven approach. But the basic gap analysis worked for us in terms of assessing where the resources are, how we could best use those resources, and what's the outcome we could get from those resources.
It makes a lot of sense. Thank you for clarifying that. So with this program, how was the program impacted with COVID? And back in February, March 2020, there was a dip in volumes and it didn't pick back up till about February, March this year. How did that impact the talent to the residency program?
So you're bringing me back 2 years ago, right? When COVID just started. So I can clearly remember that when COVID was starting to heat up, we already had a small cohort of about 30 nurses enrolled in the program, but we were planning to launch 2 cohorts every 3 months. The time that COVID hit, the natural instinct was to pause, right? But we consciously made a decision to continue with the program and do it virtual rather than pause because we can't do in person. Mm-hmm. We pivoted to virtual right away, because we knew that the evidence was strong that when you had engagement, your chances of retaining your nurses are super high rather than just leave them be in the units. So the evidence was there. But then the how was the missing piece. How do we continue the engagement in this new reality when we can't do in-person seminars? The in-person seminars that we did were very, very exciting and robust because we had film festivals. They had to record themselves and say, this is how my PICO question is. So it was a very engaging format. We had simulation, which was very hands-on. But we had to rethink all of that when the pandemic hit because suddenly we couldn't do in-person anymore. So once we get that conscious decision, deliberate decision from our boss that we need to continue, no pausing, then we really had to reinvent the way we deliver the content to our residents. And the way that we reinvented that was instead of hands-on simulation, for example, we did tabletops. Mm-hmm. You can still do tabletops in a WebEx or Zoom. We did video simulation. So instead of them watching people act out their roles, we would have them watch videos and then we critique the video. Instead of lectures, which would put people to sleep, we would do escape rooms. We gamified the content. So rather than putting people to sleep, we had to keep them awake, and we reinvented the way we delivered content by doing escape rooms. And the escape rooms that I'm describing to you is not the escape rooms where you enter a room and you figure out how to escape that room. The escape room that we did in our virtual environment was using Google Forms. So we gave them links. So the escape room was a virtual escape room. You can't escape or you can't go on to the next session without escaping that virtual room. So it got them, excited about how do I escape so that I can move on. So we also did critical reflection. Critical reflection was a big piece for our pivoting during the pandemic because we knew that the nurses, the new nurses especially, went through a lot of moral distress. They they would go home, they would feel that there were things that happened that was against their values as a new nurse. You know how new nurses coming out from nursing school, they have very high values about the profession. And when you see the reality of COVID, where people are dropping dead like flies in the waiting room, the emergency department, it makes you question the reason why you went into nursing in the first place. And so what we did in our seminars was have them go through the exercise of critical reflection. Critical reflection is a technique shown to us by the nurse residency program at Vizient, telling us, you know, you don't have to tell people how to learn. You can just have them look at their experiences and let them figure out by themselves what went well, what didn't go well, what do you want to do differently, and how are you going to incorporate that kind of mental change that you did in your head? How are you going to incorporate that in your practice when you come back to your unit? In all this critical reflection, there was small group reporting and there was big group reporting. And our senior nurses who were educators were the folks who really coached the nurses and guided them in those periods of moral distress. So I would say that the critical reflection piece was a big difference in terms of getting our nurses to really rethink their values in terms of doing nursing in a different context during the pandemic. So in short, the pandemic really didn't tell us to pause. We continued. So our seminars went from in-person to virtual. Big seminars. We had 100 participants per virtual platform, but the engagement continued. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years later, our retention rates are still higher than it has been the previous year during the pandemic. And mostly it's because of that change in the format for how we run seminars. And as another side note, Vizient, the vendor that gives us the nurse residency program, runs this program across the nation. So we had a listserv of all the educators around the nation sharing all these best practices from all over the country. So when we got to those ideas, we took what worked and we took what would not work for us in our context and just went with it. And every time we would ask our residents, how does this work for you? And our gauge was, as long as our residents keep showing up for our monthly seminar, we should feel okay. And month after month, our residents never really took a pause themselves. They showed up each and every month. Mm-hmm. Which tells us that the program is meeting their needs, because otherwise they won't show up. I mean, you've heard about this consumer confidence kind of the way that people acknowledge brands. They vote with it. They don't like Nike. They will just not buy Nikes. So our assumption was, as long as our residents kept showing up in our monthly seminars, then we're doing something that's mm-hmm. good. Part of the structure of the nurse residency program also was that our seminars are not education days, they're not off days, they're not holidays, they're not vacation days. They're regular work mm-hmm. days. So they appreciated that part, that instead of working in their unit, they had one day a month where they could do a seminar and decompress and do critical reflection and connect with the residents, the new nurses or new graduates in their group. And the main thing that they found is that whatever distress they were feeling, they're not alone. Other people are feeling it too. And so they bounce from each other in terms of what are the things that they do in order to fill that cup, so to speak. When their cup feels empty, they go to the seminars, they refill, and then they have their peers give them the support and the validation that you're not alone in this.
That's very insightful.
There's a whole community of new nurses that are going through what you're going through.
So in a way, you also have a peer support group.
Yeah, that's one of the documented best practice and drivers really for the nurse residency program. It's that they're not getting their motivation from the facilitators and from the directors. They're not giving that motivation from them. They're getting the motivation to continue and move on from their peers. Mm-hmm. And that's well documented in the literature that the nurse residents find a value in a nurse residency program, not so much from the kind of coaching that they get from the facilitators, but really from the kind of interaction with their peers who are in the same boat as them and who are having the same struggles as them, who are having the same challenges as them in keeping up and coping with the difficult nursing practice that they're thrown into.
That's very insightful. As you were talking about the critical reflection, the very thing that came to mind is nurse resilience. And when you mentioned, when you described that, it really resonated with me because even in my time being the ER manager, we had a lot of issues with nurse resilience or just staff resilience in general. And having that integrated in a residency program is very valuable. And to your point, you know, you have the peer support group, which is evidence-based back, and you can see results right there and then. And it really adds to that self-reflection, going back to why I went to nursing to begin with, and taking right. that sense of ownership of their professional career and a sense of purpose.
So it really gave the new nurses a whole new meaning for why they chose nursing and why they chose us. Because as an example, one of the things that the residents were sharing in the seminars was, I can't go home to my family because I have two kids. So I'm struggling with going back and forth in the subway because the subways are down. And, you know, there's no cabs because no cabs in the city. So how do I go to work the next day? So it turns out that the system had a hotel program that in the hospital that she worked, there was a hotel a couple of blocks from it where the system has rented rooms for staff to stay. And so they don't have to go home if they didn't want to go. So just having that kind of resource shared with new nurses who may be clueless about what resources are available to them was a big deal. Because during the pandemic, we were just, sharing the information was very, very inefficient. So when those seminars happened, it was getting the information from the other residents that really sustained our new nurses to continue to practice the way they did.
So you mentioned a lot about engagement, and this, what you described, sounded like it really helped with maintaining and sustaining that engagement. With that, you have an engaged staff. How did that impact the care experience by the patients in general?
So in terms of care experience, we don't have evidence of a cause and effect right now. But what we have are pockets of good experiences, care experiences in some of the hospitals that we have, where the goal of nurse communication being at a certain percentage has been met and exceeded. But so far, we don't have that widespread evidence that tells us that nurse communication improved significantly because of the nurse residency program. In the literature, they don't cite patient experience as an outcome of a nurse residency program, but it's certainly something that needs further study, because what we don't know is, when you have engaged nurses, how does that result into a satisfied patient? We just don't know that outcome yet because it hasn't been studied that much. But it's an opportunity for study now that you've mentioned it.
Well, I guess, you know, coming from this old adage that we have happy nurses, happy patients.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So you talked about engagement. You talked about the critical reflection program or part of that program. How did you integrate that with holding a sense of accountability with the team? How did you set a high standard to maintain quality metrics and then keeping them engaged?
So the critical reflection as part of the seminar was a session that was maybe an hour or 2 hours long in the beginning of the day. And that critical reflection began with their recollection of the story. And then they share that story to a small group. And then the small group shares the story that they've selected into a bigger group. The comments from the facilitators who were giving them feedback about their experiences varied really depending on the story that they shared. Some of them shared stories of mistakes, which were, of course, anonymous because we asked them to really don't mention any patient identifiers or even coworkers to make this more of a learning experience rather than a very, you know, traumatic experience. So that sharing was subjected to feedback from the facilitators who were experienced nurses. So that was a model for the experienced nurses coaching the new graduate nurses through stories. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the metrics, we just made critical reflection a permanent part of every seminar that we had since then. And I guess in terms of outcome measurement, we could always use the retention rate as a metric for the effectiveness of the critical reflection. But then another thing that we do when our residents graduate is we ask them to share their 12-month experience in the residency program. And part of the big recollections that they have during those testimonies during graduation, which drove a lot of people to tears, was the way that they shared their stories and the way that their stories were validated by their coworkers that, oh, yeah, that happened to me too. But then the other part was, you know, all these senior nurses who had 30 years of experience under the belt telling them, I can remember the days when I was in your shoe. And this is how I dealt with it. Mm-hmm. So that was our measure of effectiveness for the way that critical reflections were working. Because at graduation, when we asked a couple of residents, share what the 12 months has been. Critical reflection was a big piece of their testimony. It was a very rough kind of metric for looking at the effectiveness of that particular intervention.
It sounded like it had a positive outcome. Thank you. So Dr. Bolaro, can you share your practical advice to other nurse leaders during these challenging times?
I think for nurse leaders, the big thing is recruiting nurses is going to predict the success of healthcare organizations. Right now, we have staffing shortages, but recruiting nurses only go so far if you can keep them. Mm-hmm. So leaders have to really spend much more effort in getting their nurses engaged once their nurses are in the door and have joined the team. I don't know if you remember this nurse from the 1970s, a nurse theorist that talked about reality shock. It's a phenomenon described by Marilyn Kramer in the 1970s, where when he studied new nurses who were new graduates, she said that for all the nurses that she studied who were new hires and new graduates, they go through this phase of reality shock. Reality shock is a way to navigate staying or leaving nursing once you start your career. In her predictable phase of ups and downs in that phenomenon, she describes things like the honeymoon phase, where maybe in the first few months of orientation, you're giddy, you're upbeat, you're excited because you're getting a job after graduation. Mm-hmm. So you're feeling very nice, very positive. But that honeymoon phase quickly goes downslope. It goes through a rejection phase, goes through a bottom phase of describing something like, I want to quit because this is not what I signed up to. But then they eventually recover to a recovery phase where they accept the realities of the job and then they reconcile their values with the realities of the job. And that's the phenomenon that Marilyn Kramer has described as reality shock. Everybody goes through that. So that's where the context of a nurse residency program comes in. New nurses who are new graduates have a higher chance of leaving the profession altogether if you don't support them. So you run the risk of your nurses quitting the profession altogether if you don't fill that gap of a transition program, which the nurse residency program offers. So it's all based on outcome, yes, the 10-year program that it's been done throughout the nation. There's strong outcome that it works, but it's also based on a theoretical framework of Marilyn Kramer, where she borrows from the sociology literature and talks about, you know, the normal kind of emotions that a new nurse orientee goes through when they're coming in the door and they are new graduates and they're like fish thrown in the ocean for all the sharks to circle around. And your hope is that they sink or swim. But then the nurse residency program is sort of a lifeboat or a life raft that you throw at these residents who are thrown in the ocean. And it gives them a support system that they can hang on to so they can survive. And then they survive and they ultimately decide to stay with nursing as something that is a vocation that they can continue to work with.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
My recommendation is that every nurse leader should know about reality shock and should walk the shoes of new nurses who are new graduates and just empathize at how terrifying it can be if you're a new nurse, a new graduate starting a new job. And if you don't get the help that you desperately need, you're just going to decide to quit. Mm-hmm. And if these people quit, who's going to take care of us when we grow old?
I agree. As you mentioned that, it reminded me of an article I read, I believe it was published about a week or so ago on LinkedIn. And the title of this article was, Why Are Workers Looking to Change Industries? The main gist of this is that it lists the top reasons that why workers in general leave to different industries. And they cited the number one was better compensation, which tops the list at 54% of respondents considering a different industry. And the second was better alignment with personal values is nearly as common at 48%. So very close. And to your point, really critical reflection and all that, it really resonates a lot with how do we connect with them from a values-based approach and assist them as they go through that moral injury or they go through the reality shock as you described, which I found interesting was that on the other hand of this study, what ranked the lowest on the list is a reduced chance of exposure to COVID. So COVID was even the lowest of the list that people are not worried about COVID, which I find really fascinating that people are tuned to aligning with their values, which resonates a lot with me. So Dr. Bolaro, thank you so much for this opportunity to have this engaging and insightful conversation with you. And how can our listeners connect with you?
they can check out my LinkedIn profile and I have a contact information there.
Okay.
I have a personal Facebook account, but that's personal.
Well, thank you again for your time. This is such a very insightful conversation.
Thank you for listening. To view the complete show notes and all the links mentioned in today's episode, visit milesperillaconsulting.com/podcast. And before you go, make sure you follow or subscribe to this podcast so you can receive the latest episodes as soon as they're released. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. Thank you again for joining me. This is your host, Miles Perilla, and you're listening to The Insightful Nurse Leader. I'll see you next time.